Greetings, I'm Austin Egbert, the director of Mind Matters. In this episode of Mind Matters, Robert J. Marks is interviewed by Larry Linenschmidt, executive director of the Hill Country Institute. Today's topic is the astonishing limitations of artificial intelligence when viewed through a computer science perspective. This interview was originally aired by the Hill Country Institute at their website, hillcountryinstitute.org, and is included here in its entirety. This is part one of two parts.
Welcome to Hill Country Institute Live, the program that brings you together with Christian leaders, authors, and pastors to discuss major issues of our time. We seek to encourage and equip followers of Jesus Christ to know His heart and mind in all that we do. I'm Larry Linenschmidt, your host, and I thank you for joining us today. We have a special and unusual program today with a Christian leader who works in academia, who works with artificial intelligence, neural networks, computers, and all those things that those of us who aren't very technical wonder, how do they work? How should a Christian think about artificial intelligence? So stay with us. You'll want to hear the story of how Dr. Robert Marks, professor at Baylor University, works with artificial intelligence and all those computer capabilities that seem so complicated to us non-technical folks. We invite you to visit our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, to hear podcasts of our past programs on topics including faith and work, science and art, fighting human trafficking, and many other topics. Our guests have included Oz Guinness and Dan Davis and Andy Crouch, Mayor Ivy Taylor of San Antonio, and lots of other folks who are on the cutting edge of what Christians are doing today to interact with our world. The website also offers audio and video from our past conferences and seminars on faith and science and faith and art and C.S. Lewis and much more. Our radio programs are available on any podcast service as well as at our website, hillcountryinstitute.org. On the podcast, they're Hill Country Institute Live. The program is supported by donations. We'd ask you to consider donating or supporting the program in some way. For donations over $100, we have a copy of Jay Richards' book on the topic that we're talking about today, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in the Age of Smart Machines. And Jay Richards is a scholar and previous guest on our program. To donate to Hill Country Institute, please visit our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, or call 512-680-7993. hillcountryinstitute.org, 512-680-7993. Now let's welcome our special guest, Bob Marks. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest today, Dr. Robert J. Marks II. He's Distinguished Professor of Engineering in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Baylor University. He was attracted to Baylor after 26 years at the University of Washington in Seattle by Baylor's vision of being the home of cutting-edge research while celebrating the Lordship of Christ. While he was at the University of Washington for 16 years, he was the Campus Crusade faculty advisor, and he's still involved in working with student ministry through advising Rocio Christi and the American Scientific Affiliation student chapter at Baylor University. He was the first president of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers Neural Network Society. He's a fellow of the IEEE, the Institute of Electric and Electronic Engineers, and he's program director of the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence. He's authored, co-authored, edited over 400 publications. And if I continue all the things on my list to introduce him, we won't have a program. So let's just stop right there and say, Bob, thank you for being with us today. We appreciate you being our guest.
Thank you very much. You mentioned 400 publications. That's kind of like saying somebody has pounded 400 nails in a piece of wood. So I should probably say that some of those publications are pretty good.
All right, I think so. And okay. if you keep invited back to peer-reviewed publications, then they have to be pretty good, don't they?
Well, not really, but that's a topic for another day.
Okay, so. that's a good discussion. You know, my friend Jim Garvin, who teaches at Baylor, and I talk about peer review and the process quite a bit, so I have some insight for it. But I want you to know we have great appreciation for Christians who are in science and technology, and in your work in the area of information and technology and artificial intelligence is really on the cutting edge. So we'd like for our audience today to get to know you a little bit personally, and then we want to get into the science of computers and robots and artificial intelligence, or AI. So if you're listening and you hear AI, it's not just like old MacDonald had a farm, and I'm going back to the refrain. It's artificial intelligence. And of course, that's probably a silly comment because AI is on everybody's mind today. So, Bob, what attracted you to science and electrical engineering as a young man?
Well, I think that everybody, you know, according to Scripture, has their gifts, and God gifted me to be a nerd. I just like math. I like science. I love things. I can look at the latest gadget or the latest great invention, and I can get excited, and I can see God in that. My wife, on the other hand, she looks at it and yawns, and she sees beauty in a field of flowers that are beautiful. She says, "Oh, I see God there." So I think everybody has their own predisposition as to what they're good at and what they're gifted at. And again, I was gifted to be a nerd, and I appreciate it.
Well, and in this sense, you are what Tolkien refers to as a sub-creator. You're looking at these things and how they can be put together, and you're making something out of what God made to start with. For us,
yeah. In fact, I had a grandfather had a third grade education. He once told me, he says, "Nothing man has ever done, God hasn't done before," in some sense. And I think he's probably right. So we're just replicating what we see in nature. In fact, one of my societies, the IEEE Computational and Society, used to have a logo which said that, not a logo, but a saying that said that we look to nature to find out the new things that we can do. And in fact, neural networks, if you talk about artificial neural networks, that's the attempt to replicate the human brain. So we're looking at a creation, and then we're trying to borrow from that in engineering sort of application sense. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. Well, let me ask you back to thinking as a young person. Do you recommend science and technology as areas of study for young Christians?
Only if you're gifted in it. I think that there's this effort now for STEM. STEM stands for what? Science, technology, engineering, and math. And it's kind of like the idea that one size fits all. But not everybody is supposed to go into the STEM fields. If you're not gifted in mathematics and a love for science, you shouldn't go in there. You should find out whatever area is that you're interested in. Go in there and flourish in the way that you've been gifted.
But if you are gifted in those areas and you feel like God has particularly given you an interest like he did you, then is it a good calling? Is it a valid calling?
Oh, it's an incredible valid calling. I think that you know, you don't have to go to the ministry to actually be a good Christian or to follow Christ. I think you can do that if no matter what area you go into. In fact, I feel it's a blessing that I'm doing what I'm doing now and can still serve the Lord. What a blessing to do what you love to do. I think Solomon said in Ecclesiastes that the only thing that is really good under the sun is the good feeling that you have after a good solid day's work. So That's exactly the way that I feel, and just feel blessed in life that I can do what I've been called to do.
Well, God wired us to work. We worked before the fall, and that's real important theologically, because our work is fulfilling and good and honoring to Him, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes.
Well, you've been in an academic environment for pretty much all of your adult life. You were in secular universities as a student and a professor, and now you've been at Baylor for many years. What's it like to be a Christian in a secular university setting today?
Well, I've been at Baylor for about a decade and a half. I was with the University of Washington for 25 years, and I know, looking at me, you would never think that, of course, but I don't look that old. But nevertheless, sometimes it's difficult, and I think that our trials as people who believe are not always easy. We hear of things today in many of the secular universities. We don't experience it here at Baylor, because Baylor is, according to their publicity unapologetically Christian, so we don't hear it here. But at other places, you hear of parachurches such as InterVarsity and Campus Crusade and such being kicked off of campus because they cannot have the university prohibits them from requiring the president, the leadership of the organization, mm-hmm. from being followers of Christ. You can go in with any worldview or anything that you want to, according to the university. And for that reason, because these parachurch organizations like Crusade, InterVarsity, and Ratio Christi don't do that, they are kicked off of campus. And so that's very difficult. And you might think that's new, but we had this problem back in back at the University of Washington, where we were challenged for the Campus Crusade, or today it's called CRU. We were challenged that we weren't allowing leadership positions for people that had opposite ideologies of what CRU stood for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's going to be a constant struggle for us, isn't it? Well, I don't know if we're a post-Christian culture or a pre-Christian culture at this point, but we need to continue to associate with each other, support each other, and share the gospel as we can, don't we?
Yes, absolutely.
Well,
yes, sir.
One of your interests is the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence. Walter Bradley's a fellow of the Hill Country Institute. He's been an important friend to our ministry and our faith and science work, and supportive of just about every kind of work that we've done, from C.S. Lewis to how we relate as Christians to science. So it's great that this center is named after him. And would you tell us what is the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence?
Well, the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence has a website, and I'll publicize it here. It's mindmatters.ai. And I heard politicians say if you mention a website, you should mention it three times for the maximal effect. So let me say again, it's mindmatters.ai, mindmatters.ai. So it was founded in July of last year. And the purpose of this is to look at artificial intelligence from a perspective that you really don't see in the media. We try to be totally honest. We try to be scientific. We do embrace the Judeo-Christian ethic, but don't refer to Scripture. We're actually talking about the actual science and what goes on. Yeah, the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence is looking at artificial intelligence, the hype that we see in headlines today, which is pervasive, and trying to smooth some of that out and trying to bring a better perspective into a exactly what AI is. We are also interested, and this is in the history of Walter Bradley, interested in establishing sustainable and appropriate technology in majority worlds. Now, many people haven't heard of majority worlds, and I didn't either until about a month ago, but I guess developing countries is derogatory, and third world is also derogatory, so majority countries is what comes to mind. Walter Bradley went to different places, and as he took technology, appropriate technology, to the countries. Most countries don't need better computers. They need technology which is appropriate for them. So Walter Bradley did this especially with the chemistry of coconuts, and actually has founded some sustainable technologies and sustainable businesses in different countries. In the Philippines now, there's a company called Dignity Coconuts, where they have taken the incredible number of coconuts which they have available, and they've done stuff with them. And now you can buy Dignity Coconuts online at Amazon.com, where you can buy everything else in the world. And what they have done is they have established now a business in the Philippines that is run by nationals that has helped with the poverty. We have another example, which is we have just funded of a gentleman named Brian Thomas, who is going down to Haiti. Now, Brian has gone around and started little micro businesses around. Everybody in developing, I'm sorry, everybody in majority world countries has cell phones, and they all need to charge them. So Brian went around and he set up people with solar panels that could charge people to come in and charge their cell phones. And so this is a nice sustainable technology that Brian is doing in Haiti, and we're looking at expanding this in other places. So the Walter Bradley Center is also into looking at how we can impact majority world countries with advanced technology, including AI. But my area specifically is in the theoretical. I actually specialize in something, and it sounds it's a lot better than it sounds. It's a lot more fun than it sounds, but algorithmic information theory, which will actually tell us in the mathematics of computer languages what a computer can do and what a computer can't do. And that's my area of interest and expertise. But the spectrum of the Walter Bradley Center is much broader than that, as you can see.
Yes, well, and I know Walter's worked on wells, bringing water, clean water, to so many people around the world. So there are many, many aspects to what that can do. But you've kind of led us into computers, and let's think about, if we can, kind of lay the stage for what computers are, how they work. You know, the cards that I had for programs back when I was at UT in the business school were that's a long time ago, you know, and if they got out of order, I was in big trouble. And today, we've
I work with those punch cards. It was, hey, Larry, that really ages us, doesn't it?
It does, I'm afraid.
Because that was a long time ago. Yes. Kids today don't even know what those punch cards are.
Yeah, well, let's just start then. What when I read the term classical computer, how does a computer function? And then let's build on that to talk about supercomputers and kind of build into just a foundation of how these things work so that we can then talk about the theory of AI and what it is and what it isn't.
Well, computers, as we know them today, were actually popularized by Alan Turing. You might recognize his name. He had a biography in the movie The Imitation Game, where Alan Turing was played by Benedict Cumberbatch, which is a fun word to say. And Alan Turing was really a genius, and he was the one that actually invented the idea of computers. And he used a type of computer to break the Enigma code for the Nazis back in World War II. That was the subject of the movie The Imitation Game. Yeah. But basically, Turing showed the idea that computers were limited by something called algorithms. And we hear algorithms a lot, you know, such and such as doing an algorithm, and Facebook has initiated an algorithm to do something. And the question is, what is an algorithm? The algorithm is simply a step-by-step procedure to accomplish something. So if you go to your shampoo bottle and you look at the back, it says wet hair, apply shampoo, rinse, and then repeat. That's an algorithm because it tells you the step-by-step procedures that you need to wash your hair.
Well, that's a pretty short algorithm for me since I don't have much hair, but go right ahead.
Is that right? Well, the interesting thing about that algorithm is if you gave that to a computer, that computer would wash its hair forever because it doesn't say repeat once, it just says repeat.
Uh-huh.
So you would go back and you would do it again and again and again. So a proper shampoo, make sure your proper shampoo says repeat once. Uh-huh. So you don't spend all of your time in the shower shampooing your hair. But an algorithm I like to think of as a recipe. If you look at the recipe for baking a vanilla coconut cake, for example, it will tell you the ingredients that you need, and then it will give you a step-by-step procedure for doing it. And that is what an algorithm is. And in fact, it is what computers are limited to do. Computers are only able to perform algorithms. And so one of the things that we can identify that humans can do that computers can't do are things which are non-algorithmic. And if it's non-algorithmic, it means it's non-computable. Actually, Alan Turing showed back in his initial work that there were things which were not algorithmic. It's very difficult, for example, to write a computer program to analyze another computer program. And Turing showed that specific instantiations of that were non-algorithmic. So this is something which is taught to freshman computer science students. So they know what algorithmic and non-algorithmic, non-computable is. And again, non-computable is a synonym for non-algorithmic. And we have a number of aspects that we exhibit that are non-algorithmic. I would say quiet, creativity, sentience, consciousness are probably things that you cannot write a computer program to simulate. So that's kind of the background, and I think I went down a rabbit trail here a little bit, but
we're going to tie into that some more. I want to come back to what computers can and can't do and the uniqueness of the human. But in building computers, I have a cell phone that I understand has more power than a room full of computers 50 years ago that Army intelligence used. It's a massive increase in computing capability, isn't there?
Yes, there is. But what we've done is we've been able to, by increasing the speed and using parallel sort of computers, we have just increased the speed of the computers. There is a principle taught to computer science called the Church-Turing thesis, which basically says that the computers of today they're remarkable, but Alan Turing's original machine could also do what the computers today do. The only thing that computers can do today is do things a lot faster. And therefore, that is really good. That's very useful. We can do some things that we couldn't do before. But in terms of the ability of the computer, they are still restricted to algorithms. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of the quantum computer, which is kind of the new rage, where you use this strange, weird world of quantum physics in order to get computational results. Even quantum computing is algorithmic and is constrained by the Church-Turing thesis. So, yeah, we're doing things a lot faster now. With quantum computers, we're going to be doing them like lightning. But still, all of the stuff we could do with Turing's original machine. Now, with Turing's original machine, it might take us a trillion years in order to do it compared to today. But nevertheless, the capability is with Turing's original machine, and we're just getting faster and faster, and we can do more interesting things because of that speed.
Well, when I visited places like the National Renewable Energy Lab, and they have, you know, literally a large room full of the computing capability they have. I mean, it's a large structure, and it's up to date in terms of speed. And what you're saying is, all that has really done from Turing and World War II and his great work on the Enigma code is increased the speed and increased the complexity. But I'm not even sure that's the right word. Bigger and faster.
If you have greater speed, you can entertain more complexity. Absolutely.
Okay. So that's what's happening. It's still the same basic algorithm built on algorithm, and that's the limitation of the computer, that it can't do non-algorithmic functions.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. And then so another term that we'd like to just talk about a second, so we can go further with it. What is artificial intelligence? You know, how do you define that?
Well, it's what is artificial intelligence? It's interesting today. I think that artificial intelligence today means any gee whiz things which comes out of high tech and computers, and any gee whiz sort of thing that you get is called artificial intelligence. It used to be not like that. Artificial intelligence, as founded by Marvin Minsky and his lot at MIT. Would correspond to trying to take the expertise of a human and having the computer program converse with the human and write down rules. And from those rules that you write in the computer, you have an intelligence which captures the human intelligence. More modern artificial intelligence, such as neural networks and reinforcement learning, rather learns by example. That is, they are presented with a number of examples, and after a while they go, yeah, I understand the difference between a cow, a pig, and a horse, and a snake, because you've shown them this a number of times, and it begins to recognize it. So in that sense, it adapts to the data set that you give it.
Okay.
So defining artificial intelligence is a difficult thing to do because, again, I think in the media specifically, it's any gee whiz thing that comes out that involves computers.
Yeah, if it's something that sounds far out sci-fi-ish, then it's AI is what you're saying.
Yes, and it's become, unfortunately, it's become kind of a buzz hype word. that people talk about. And there's a lot of hype out there about artificial intelligence and its capabilities.
What is a neural network? How does that relate to AI?
Neural network is an attempt to take the human brain, or any brain, the mosquito brain, I don't care, any brain that you want to, and make computer code that follows that the way that the human brain is modeled. We hear a lot about neural networks today, but shoot, neural networks go back to the 1950s. There was actually a professor at Stanford named Bernie Windrow that came up with a neural network in the 1960s that could predict the weather. It could listen to your utterances and have it typed out on a computer. Back then, they didn't have computer screens. It printed it out on a kind of a typewriter. And he was able to balance brooms with it, and it was really, really exciting stuff. There was also a gentleman named Frank Rosenblatt, I believe he was with Cornell, that developed something called the Perceptron, and everybody got excited. And then an AI winter came in, and we started in, I guess it was kind of the 1990s, there was a resurgence of interest in neural networks because people came up with a way to overcome some of the limitations that the early neural networks did. And today there's a resurgence again. There has been the development of so-called deep learning, specifically deep convolutional neural networks and deep reinforcement learning that has been used, for example, to win at Go, win Go games against the world champions. And these now, I think, are the primary focuses of artificial intelligence, and we hear a lot about these sorts of things. But the basic idea behind a neural network is that you have a bunch of neurons, and these neurons in a computer are just a bunch of kind of dots, and all these neurons are kind of connected together with something called synaptic weights. In order to learn the difference between a horse, a cow, a pig, and a snake, you give the neural network the experience of seeing a bunch of these things, and with supervised learning, what you do is you say, okay, here you go. This is a snake. This is a pig. This is a horse. This is a cow. I might be using examples that were not on my list, but you get the idea.
Sure.
And then pretty soon, after repeated trials, the neural network begins to say, ooh, okay, I've seen this before. At least that's what it seems to do. All that it's done is adapt its weights in such a fashion that it does exactly what the programmer told it to do. It says, I want to look at these different categories of animals, and I'm going to tell you what these animals are, and you're going to do something. You're going to rearrange your synaptic weights. And that's what training a neural network is actually updating these weights, making them bigger or smaller. I'm going to give you an algorithm to adapt these synaptic weights so that the next time you see a picture of a cow, you'll say that that's a cow. And so that's what a neural network does. And the interesting thing about the neural network is that it doesn't rely on this idea of getting rules from people. Rather, it's something which is presented with examples. It used to be you would have to give features, which I won't go into, but now you can actually give them pictures and actually look at the pixels, and that is pretty exciting stuff. That's what deep convolutional neural networks are able to do. So, yeah, that's what a neural network does. It's the attempt to capture the way that the human brain works, and in terms of the algorithmic aspects of learning and adaptation, yeah, it's pretty successful and it's pretty useful.
That's very interesting. Now, we're going to need to take a break. We'll come back shortly. Please stay with us if you're listening. We're visiting with Dr. Robert Marks, who is a distinguished professor of engineering in electrical and computer engineering at Baylor. And we're talking about what makes AI work. And we're going to get into the people's concerns that we read about. They range from Stephen Hawking to Bill Gates, and why Dr. Marks thinks maybe we're going to be okay. We invite you to visit our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, to listen to past programs, which are also available through your podcast service as Hill Country Institute Live. We also ask for your help in supporting this program financially, since the radio stations like to be paid, and we like to pay them. Please visit hillcountryinstitute.org to make donations That's hillcountryinstitute.org. And let us know if you'd like to sponsor the program on your local radio station. You can reach us at 512-680-7993. That's 512-680-7993. Or donate online at hillcountryinstitute.org. For donations over $100, we have copies of The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work, and An Age of Smart Machines by Jay Richards, which ties in with our topic today. So please stay with us. We'll be right back with more of Hill Country Institute Live.